Right, good afternoon, welcome back. Cracking straight on then, please. Can you hear me now? Yes? I'm going to just be very brief with the introductions again so we can get some more time. Our next speaker is Inga Wise, who studied English, French and Spanish literature and worked as a simultaneous translator prior to training here at the Tavistock Clinic and the British Psychoanalytic Society. She is, like myself, a fellow of both the BPAS and the Institute of Psychoanalysis. She founded the Psychoanalytic Ideas series, published by the Institute, which she co-edited with Paul Williams until 2011. She works in private practice, teaches and supervises in the UK and abroad, and has been much in demand. And music, as she very nicely reminds us, has been a constant in her life. Please welcome Inga Wise.
Well, first of all, I also wish to thank the Freud Museum for asking me to write. And I'm glad to see that so many of you are still here this afternoon. And I hope you'll still be here at the end of my lecture. Okay. Die Walküre, a tale of Oedipal longings and desires. Close to 5 decades before Freud began to think about and formulate his theory of the Oedipus complex, Wagner wrote Die Walküre, the poem libretto, as well as composing the music about Oedipal love amongst a family of what we would nowadays call dysfunctional gods and mortals. Did Wagner see any connection at a conscious level between the different Oedipal relationships in the way that Freud was able to? The question is open. Though he did portray superbly the inner conflicts his characters were struggling with in the poem and the music. I will be looking at Die Walküre as though it were a case history, and I will be talking about the Oedipal entanglements we encounter. I shall now remind you briefly of Freud's theory of the Oedipal complex, followed by a briefer mention of the Oedipal myth based on the Theban plays by Sophocles, which were first performed in 429 BC, that is. In the interpretation of dreams, Freud says in the year 1900, Oedipus Rex moves a modern audience no less than it did the contemporary Greek one. There must be something which makes a voice within us ready to recognize the compelling force of destiny in Oedipus. Freud used the term Oedipus complex first in 1910. Having started to think about this area of psychosexual development since the death in 1896 of his father when he saw Oedipus Rex performed, he postulated that small children develop first a passionate love for mother, wanting to procreate with her. Girls, finding they were lacking a penis, transferred their passionate desire to their fathers. During latency, these feelings succumbed to repression, while identification with the same-sex parents led to the eventual resolution of the Oedipal complex. Castration anxiety for boys and penis envy for girls were part of Freud's theoretical framework. He considered the Oedipal complex to be fundamental to all humankind. In the 1920s-30s, Melanie Klein put the onset of the Oedipal constellation within the first year of life. This is much earlier than the age of 3 as stipulated by Freud. Now, I assume that you are all familiar with the legend of Oedipus, who killed his father and wed his mother. To escape the prophecy that his son would kill him, Laius, king of Thebes, decides to have his son killed before his son kills him. The infant has his feet tied and pierced, and is exposed in the mountains to die of exposure. A passing shepherd finds him and takes him to Corinth. Oedipus is adopted by the king and queen of Corinth and brought up as their own. As a young man, Oedipus consults the oracle to ascertain if the king and queen are his real parents. He is told by the oracle that he will wed his own mother and kill with his own hands his own sire. In order to avoid this, as he thinks they are his real parents, he leaves Corinth. On his way to Thebes, he comes across Laius's chariot and kills him and all but one servant in a fight. He then goes on to solve the Sphinx's riddle, thus freeing Thebes from the Sphinx. He is now offered the kingship of Thebes by the grateful populace, with Jocasta just widowed as his wife. They have children, and after many years of peaceful rule, a plague descends on Thebes. It will be lifted only after Laius's murderer is found. Oedipus is eventually unmasked as the killer. Jocasta, on hearing that Oedipus had killed Laius, his father, and that she had wed her own son, hangs herself. Oedipus blinds himself on finding her. Strong stuff. Now, the Walküre is the only opera of the Ring cycle that is performed on its own. Its great appeal lies in this. We, the public, watching and listening to the glorious music and singing, empathize and identify with the characters on stage. We are moved by their plight. Who are they? Let us start with the unfortunate twins, Sieglinde and Siegmund. We encounter Siegmund finding refuge in a house deep in the forest. He had been called upon to defend a maid who was being forcibly married by her family. In defending her, he kills her brothers. She herself is killed. What was meant to rescue the girl ends in total disaster, with Siegmund fleeing for his life, his sword broken. From the first moment of laying his eyes on Sieglinde, Siegmund is drawn to her. The instructions in the libretto are, he fixes his eyes on Sieglinde with growing interest. The attraction, the falling in love is instant. They do not yet know that they are each other's long-lost twins. Sieglinde's husband arrives. He notices how similar they look. Siegmund is asked to give account of himself. Who is he and why is he here? Now, he gives his name as Wewald. We in German is sorrow. He resides in sorrow. Sorrowful. Yeah, woeful, you would say in English. Now, Siegmund relates the loss of home, of mother, of twin sister, and the loss of father after several years of being hunted by the Nidings. Again, the word Neid in German is envy in English. These are the envious ones, and they turn out to be Hunding's clan. Then Siegmund says that he scarcely remembers mother and sister. This, of course, is childhood amnesia that we see at work here. Deeply traumatized by his losses and of any sense of belonging, the socializing influence of family life missing, Siegmund finds himself at odds with those whose company he thought when he left the forest. He laments, "If I sought to win a friend or a wife, I was outlawed ever. Whatever I advised as right, others considered wrong. Whatever seemed bad to me, others approved of." I find it very interesting that at this point in the opera, my counter-transference is I would not like to encounter or know this man, traumatized and persecuted though he is. He appears unfeeling, psychopathic almost. He seems to have no understanding of the impact of his actions. Asperger syndrome comes to mind. And yet, as Siegmund is left alone, knowing that he will fight for his life in the morning, we discover a very different man. Tender, longing to belong, loyal. He calls for his out for his father. Where is the sword Welser promised? He longs for Sieglinde. She returns, and their passion is ignited. Sieglinde is like her twin, deeply traumatized by the loss of family, home, and all that was familiar to her. She probably was witness to her mother's murder. She was taken and eventually given to Hunding in a loveless marriage. She feels and has been dishonored and abused. She tells Siegmund of the sword that her father left in the ash tree at the center of her home, of their home. It is yet to be claimed. She wishes that he should be the hero to claim it. Now here is the sword that Siegmund has been promised by his father, a potent phallic symbol of masculinity. Siegmund says to Sieglinde, "Your presence gives me life." They embrace, and there follows that wonderful aria, or those two arias we have heard as we came in, "Winterstürme wichen dem Wonnemond," und "Du bist der Lenz," is her reply, "You are the spring for which I yearned." Here is a preconscious recognition of their friendship, which is alive in both of them, and memories of childhood arise. Sieglinde says, "My eyes have beheld you before, and she has heard his voice before, or is it an echo of her own voice?" She recognizes her father in him, their father in him, and she names him Siegmund. Now, having pulled Noting out of the ash tree and claimed his male potency, Siegmund claims Sieglinde as sister and bride. "Bride and sister are you to the brother, so may the race of the Volsungs flourish." The curtain falls, we are enraptured by the music, the singing, and we want Siegmund and Sieglinde flee to safety and to be united. We are not shocked by the incest they are about to commit. Alessandra Piontelli, in her book From Fetus to Child, 1992, presents four observations of twins, starting in utero with the observation via scans and ending at age 4. Her remarkable findings concluded that in both identical and non-identical twins, behavior observed in utero continued throughout the period of observation. That is, the twin who in utero initiated physical contact with the other continued to do so after birth and on. This means that the bond established in utero between them was equal in terms of attachment to their bond to mother. They knew each other before they knew mother. Now, twins have two objects from birth, mother and the other twin. During the first few weeks of every infant's life, mothers in their primary maternal preoccupation, that is Winnicott's word, feed us, look after us, keep us alive. They hold us both physically and emotionally. Mothers fall in love with their babies, as do fathers. Babies fall in love with their mother, and a bit later with father. This anchors the infant to life. It engenders joie de vivre. By 6 weeks, infants respond to smiles and initiate them. Nowadays, many fathers are involved in the care of their infants, babies and children, sharing in their upbringing, from birth. I've heard young couples say, we are pregnant. Men, young men, now are attuned to the growing baby in utero more than they ever were. They go to the scans, they're there at birth, they take paternity leave, they change nappies. Though, of course, they can't breastfeed, they will bottle feed where and when. Infants become aware of their fathers earlier, of triangulation, that is, than was the norm. This has an impact on the infant. We will have to rethink our theoretical framework on early child development to take account of father's greater and earlier presence. We speak of triangulation when the infant realizes that the mother-infant dyad becomes a triad, that is, a three-person relationship. I'm now bringing several examples from clinical work. First, a very young child. Max, 3 months old, the youngest of three, sleeps at night in a Moses basket next to mother's side of the parental bed. He finishes feeding at mother's right breast. Father has woken up. His head leans against mother's shoulder. He watches smiling. Max lets go of the breast. Mother turns him over. Max stretches his right arm. His hand finds and gets hold of father's ear. He touches it. He, quotes, plays with it contentedly for a few moments. It seemed as though Max, aged 3 months, had found father and that he was content that he was not the only person in mother's life. Not every infant takes this discovery of father's role in mother's life, the discovery of triangulation, with such ease. The next example shows a much more difficult accommodation to the presence of the third person, experience in the transference of an adult, and not a patient. Some 20 years ago, I was consultant to a project that researched the identity of adolescents in post-communist regimes. There was a standard interview which was filmed. The method was to study the interviewee dynamic as well as the content. After 6 months, the researchers decided to change the methodology to include the observer's countertransference. A move from studying a dyad to studying a triad. To understand the change, we had a meeting of all involved. We agreed to include our countertransference dreams and fantasies relating to the material and to the conference. We had structured and ad hoc meetings. In one of these, I found myself alone with a male consultant, while all other colleagues had formed age-related groups. We wondered if we represented the parental couple, a wished-for united parental couple, perhaps. It had been a feature throughout the project that fathers had been mostly absent in the lives of adolescents in the post-communist regimes. On getting back together in the large group, some 20 in all, it was made clear that we were dealing with triangulation. The colleague who had been coupled with me in the prior self-selected session reacted as though this was a betrayal on a very personal level. He wanted to quit the research project. He felt that I had led him to believe that the dyad was going to be there to stay, that I had personally betrayed him. Though he included the whole group in his sense of being wronged and misled. When I pointed out that what he was in touch with was the sense of betrayal that a small child can feel, when it dawns on him or her that it is not the only center in mother's life, center of importance, of love and of affection, that there is father, a third person, that this is what the Oedipal complex is about. He understood immediately, to his and our great relief. I think that we all recognized, a faint echo perhaps, of some familiar distress in ourselves. This is the first disappointment in love the baby experiences early in life. It felt devastating to my colleague in the transference. The passionate feelings of love and hatred that the infant baby experiences belongs to infant sexuality, the oral stage. Genital sexuality does not develop until the cusp of puberty. By age 3 or 4 to 4, little boys want to marry mother. Little girls will announce to all and sundry that they will marry daddy. They passionately love the parent of the opposite sex, while both loving and hating the other parent. I'm now moving to slightly older children. James, aged 3 and a half, found an elegant solution to the dilemma of what to do with his father, who obviously stood in his way of marrying his mother. He announced, "I will marry mummy so that daddy can be king." His sister, at a similar age, had declared one morning, standing at mother's side of the parental bed, "I will have these when you die," playing with mother's rings and bracelet on the bedside table, "and I will marry daddy." Now we are going back to Max, who is now aged 4 and a half and has just started school. He tells mother, "The boys at school said that I can't marry you." He watches mother intently to see how she will take this. Mother smiles, a bit sad that this period, when her son wants to marry her, has now come to an end. "Yes," is her reply, "I know. Isn't it a shame?" Seeing that mother can cope with this news, Max goes on to say, "Don't worry, mummy, I will marry Rosie," Rosie being his older sister. Needless to say that the boys told him the next day that he could not marry his sister either. Yes, we smile, but the child who has just been informed that he cannot marry mother or father experiences a very painful disappointment. The child has no choice in the matter. It has to renounce his, her Oedipal love for the parent. Repression sets in. Our Oedipal feelings now reside mostly in our unconscious. In psychoanalytic circles, we have tended to think that the Oedipal narcissistic wound never heals completely. And we are a bit depressive about it, I think. On thinking about the Walküre and its Oedipal theme, I have come to understand that the joyful, affectionate, sensuous Oedipal relationship of early childhood, when internalized, is the source of our vitality and of our love of life. It seems to me that this has greater impact on our personality structure than renouncing our original love object sexually. Now let us return to Sieglind and Siegmund and to incest. They are, of course, non-identical twins. They are siblings conceived at the same time. Siblings who are raised separately and to meet in adulthood do not seem to have the same defenses against incest that siblings who grew up in the same household have. Siegmund and Sieglinde's mutual attraction quickly becomes passionate, falling in love. This has to do with the unconscious memories of an intimate, happier, shared early childhood. It must have felt to them as though the traumatic events of total loss of all that had been familiar to them could now be reversed, that they could re-find the paradise lost of their first years of life. Siegmund replaces mother with as his Oedipal object with his sister Sieglinde, as Max wished to do. Sieglinde, his twin, had been his Oedipal object in childhood. Sieglinde likewise replaces the lost father with her twin brother. Both seem to understand that Welse, their father, has meant for them to meet again, when he thrust Notung into the ash tree for Siegmund to claim. Notung is not only a magic sword, it is also the symbol of male sexuality and potency that Siegmund, through identifying with his father, is given as Welse had promised him. At some level of consciousness, they assume that Welse foresaw their reunion as lovers, and there is no sense of guilt in either twin at their incestuous sexual union. This is in stark contrast to the rest of us mortals. 1912, in Totem and Taboo, Freud speaks of the horror of incest that exists in all societies, however primitive. From time immemorial, strict rules applied, prohibiting sexual relations within the tribal family. In some societies, such as the Australian Aboriginals, this interdict applied also to those belonging to the same totem, though they most often were not blood relatives. The taboo on incest, rigidly enforced, gave rise to art, culture, and civilization, eventually. And it was probably the greatest achievement of early man. I have no time here to consider the enormous psychological damage done to those participating when incest does take place. So I just wanted to say that. In the opera and in life, the death of both twins is unavoidable. Fricka, as goddess of marriage, sides with Hunding, the betrayed husband. The twins have committed adultery, and far worse, they have transgressed the law prohibiting incest. Fricka insists that Wotan withdraws the magic power from Notung and his protection from his son. Siegmund has to die. Incest flourishes in the union of twins, she tells Wotan. Where was it ever seen that brother and sister were lovers? She confronts Wotan, telling him that it is his duty, as Godhead, to uphold the rule of law, including the incest taboo. The future of the gods depends on this. I will now briefly speak about the father-son relationship, Wotan and Siegmund. Wotan has need of a free man, a man who has free will, and who can fight Fafnir, as he himself cannot do it. As Welse, he procreates with a mortal. Siegmund and Sieglinde exist because Wotan needs that hero. Siegmund's life is prescribed by Wotan Welse's plan to defeat Fafnir and Alberich in order to preserve Valhall and the preeminence of the gods. The loss of family and home, the years in the wilderness, Sieglinde's bondage, and Siegmund's abandonment in the forest, the magic sword promise, it is all foretold. Though Wotan loves Siegmund, he is responsible for his death by breaking the sword, his sword, the father killing his son, as Laius intended to kill Oedipus. Wotan's greed and hunger for power led to his being cursed by Alberich, and he laments to Brunhilde, what I love I must forsake, kill what I hold most dear. deceitfully betray him who trusts me. Siegmund dies betrayed by the father he trusted. Wotan and Brunhilde and the Valkyrie sisters. With puberty comes a revival of Oedipal desires to do with the arrival of genital sexuality. It is important that the adolescent can feel desired and loved without the parent of the opposite sex transgressing boundaries. It is equally important that the same-sex parent can tolerate the attraction that still exists between mother and son and father and daughter. Only then can the adolescent renounce the parental Oedipal object and turn to someone their own age group in a loving and sexual relationship. This needs to be tolerated and approved of by the parent before the young woman, man, can go on to form a long-term relationship. However, before this can happen, the adolescent has to be able, in Winnicott's words, to kill the parent in their mind, or to put it less dramatically, to rebel against the parent. Brunhilde does exactly this when she decides to fight for Siegmund against the strict orders of Wotan. She is moved by this mortal half-brother who puts his devotion and love for Sieglinde above all else. He forgoes being one of the few select heroes to live in everlasting glory in Valhalla with the gods and to find Valsa there, because women are not allowed in Valhalla. She is deeply touched by his grief at being betrayed by Valsa. She offers to protect Sieglinde and the child she conceived after his death. It is his reply, "If I must fall prey to death, I will kill her first in her sleep." Brunhilde promises to protect him in his fight with Hunding against the express orders of Wotan. Brunhilde is Wotan's favorite child, born from his affair with Erda, the oldest, wisest Valar. Wotan, in quotes, bartered a child for Erda's knowledge of what the future had in store for the gods, and Brunhilde was born. I am perhaps stretching a point here in seeing in Erda the oldest, wisest Valar, a mother figure with whom Wotan has Brunhilde and her 8 Valkyrie sisters. Wotan keeps his Valkyrian daughters close to him. They obey his orders and do his bidding. They are Amazons, who collect fallen heroes from the battlefield. They are in awe of their godfather, Wotan. They, unlike Brunhilde, dare not break their Oedipal ties to their father for fear of being cast out from the parental home. Brunhilde rebels against Wotan's orders. She identifies with the young lovers who belong to her generation. She receives terrible punishment. Wotan strips her of her goddess status, expulses her from Valhalla, and forbids her sisters to have contact with her or to help her. He threatens them with the same fate should they not obey. Brunhilde is to fall into deep sleep. The first mortal man to come along to claim her as his wife, she will have to follow and obey. This is the appalling vengeance of a father who has not renounced his Oedipal wishes for his daughter. Brunhilde appeals to his better nature and for the love they have for each other, asking him to protect her with fire so that only the bravest of heroes will conquer her. "Was my crime so terrible?" she asks. Wotan relents. He kisses her goodbye with great sadness, the sadness parents feel at conscious or other level when their beloved children finally enter the world of adult sexual relations, when in reality they renounce their Oedipal claims on their children. Wotan has Loge ignite a high wall of fire around the place where Brunhilde rests, asleep, waiting for Siegfried, the son of her half-siblings, of her half-sibling twins, to waken her. Thank you.